the tar sands in the ground, the coal under mountain tops. 'Cause we need clean air in our lungs and clean water in our cups. Yes, we can say no tar sands. This pipeline points to hell, and true homeland security is something you don't sell. You don't trade our children's birthrights for a mess of tar. If you like the climate livable and our coasts right where they are, leave the tar sands in the ground, the coal under mountain tops. 'Cause we need clean air in our lungs and clean water in our cups. President Obama, we helped put you where you are. Now don't you trade American birthrights for a mess of tar. Yes, you can say no tar sands. This pipeline points to hell. True homeland security is something you don't sell. Leave the tar sands in the ground, the coal under mountain tops. 'Cause we need clean air in our lungs, clean water. Sacrifice, well, I believe we are, 'cause we like our climate livable and our coasts right where they are. So leave the tar sands in the ground, the coal under mountain tops, 'cause we need clean air in our lungs and clean water in our cups. Yes, we need clean air.
Welcome and thank you for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and today's program is Obama on the Couch. Dr. Justin A. Frank is interviewed by Peter B. Collins. Dr. Justin Frank talks about his new book, Obama on the Couch, Inside the Mind of the President. Dr. Frank is a clinical professor of psychiatry at George Washington University, and previously wrote Bush on the Couch.
Dr. Justin Frank returns to our program today. We first met him when he published Bush on the Couch several years back, and we've talked to him in the intervening years. And at last, he has published Obama on the Couch. Justin Frank is a psychiatrist, and he's a clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at George Washington University in D.C., and he maintains a private practice as well. But Barack Obama has never been on his couch and is not one of his patients. Justin Frank, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back. Well, I always learn more than you learn on these shows.
Oh, I don't know. I think it'll be a real good exchange today because you know a lot more about the underlying psychological issues that affect the president's public behavior. And I learned a lot from your book. It's quite instructive. And one of the things I'd like to do before we dive into your commentary and analysis is just briefly recap for people the very difficult childhood that he had, because I think that the separation from his real father, the ins and outs with his mom and the caretaking by his grandparents, a stepfather who was there for a period of time, all these are important factors in the president's psychological development. So yes. Let's start with what we know, and despite what Orly Tates or Donald Trump might say, Barack Obama was born in Hawaii, Honolulu, on August 4th of 1961.
Yes.
His parents had only been married for 6 months, and
right.
That's an issue. He was conceived out of wedlock. It doesn't quite make him a bastard, according to the dictionary definition, but it is a source of some embarrassment. His parents had a shotgun wedding, and he was born about 6 months later.
Correct. In fact, it brings up the very first kind of question that one can ask about him, which is that he discussed in his famous speech that really put him on the national map, which was his 2004 Democratic Convention speech in Boston, when he mm-hmm. talked about how I don't see a red states and blue states, I see the United States. One of the things he talked about in that speech, and has talked about since, is the improbable love between his parents. Mm-hmm. Between a black man from Africa and a white woman from Kansas. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's an improbable love because it's improbable that it was love. And I think that that's something that's always been hard to talk for him, mm-hmm. Talk about for him. The idea that it was a shotgun marriage, that the father, literally, they hardly ever were together. They didn't live together for very long, maybe a month. And then that was it.
And Barack Obama Sr. was a bigamist. He was married, had a wife and child in Kenya at the time that he took vows with Stanley Ann Dunham in Hawaii.
That's right. He was a bigamist. And then he... she went away and went to Washington State, the University of Washington, with Obama when he was a baby,
mm-hmm.
And then came back to Hawaii right before Barack Sr. graduated. And then there's this myth that he wanted to go to Harvard. Well, he did go to Harvard, but that he had got a scholarship that was enough that could take the whole family to NYU, and preferred Harvard. But I'm sure it was because he preferred to not be with his wife, his Hawaiian wife, and with the baby.
Mm-hmm.
So he left, and he was actually thrown out of Harvard, deported for some kinds of behavior problems that he was having,
and
went back to Kenya. But, I mean, the main point is that he was not a real great guy in lots of ways. And the mother, however, who was then really a child herself, she was 19, really spent made a tremendous effort to try to build up his reputation with her son,
and
spent a lot of time trying to improve how he was seen, to make sure that that young Barack had, who was called Barry, had a very positive image of African Americans, and felt really positive about his skin color, because basically he was a black skin color child raised in a white family. So that was mm-hmm. the first thing about his childhood.
Yeah. Now, Dad leaves for Harvard, and then there is one other encounter between Barack Obama and his father in 1971. And when you add it all up, how much contact did the president have with his father during his entire childhood?
Well, that was the only real contact he had, because it's not clear whether he had any contact before that. In mm-hmm. fact, he said in his autobiography that he met his father for the first time when he was 10.
71.
So I take that at its word.
And that was a visit that Barack Sr. made to Hawaii for about a month?
He made a visit to Hawaii right around Christmas time of 1971. So Barack had just had his 10th birthday in August. And the reason for the visit, in part, was the visit was facilitated by the fact that the father was recovering from a car accident that he had. And so he was unable to work. And so he actually arrived and had a cane and to help him walk. And spent a month with Barry there.
Mm-hmm.
And then they set him up in an apartment that was separate from where Stanley Ann was.
Because they had divorced by that time. She divorced him in about 1964.
Yeah, she divorced him in 1964, remarried in 1966 to Lolo Sotero.
Right.
And who was an Indonesian man, also very political and very almost radical in his political beliefs,
mm-hmm.
Who she met. And then she went to Jakarta with Barry when he was 6. Lolo lived with the family for the 2 years before that with Stanley Ann and with young Barry. And he really was the only father that Barry knew, I
mm-hmm.
think. In a deep way.
Right. And just to summarize briefly, Ann Dunham, Stanley was her father's name, and I'm sure she got a lot of boy named Sue jokes over the years, so I'll resist that temptation. But she went to Jakarta and took Barack with her son.
From 67 to 71.
Right. She and her son went to Jakarta. She worked for the U.S. International Development Agency.
Yes.
She also worked for the Ford Foundation. So
yes.
They were there together in Indonesia for 4 years, and then she sent him back to Hawaii, but stayed in Indonesia herself, returning a year later. And then she was there from 72 to 75 with Barack Jr. As he was in high school, and then she returned to Indonesia in 1975 with her daughter, but not with Barry or Barack.
Right, who she did invite to go with her,
mm-hmm.
Supposedly, and he said that he would rather stay with his friends and stay behind.
Right. And then the second marriage of Stanley Ann Dunham ended in divorce in 1980. She and Lolo parted then. And just to round it out, she died young at the age of 52. And Barack's father died in a car accident shy of the age of 62. So here is, you know, in thumbnail sketch, a very difficult childhood for him to traverse. And this, I think, is important when you start to analyze the very personal and intimate disclosures that he makes in Dreams of My Father.
Yes. First of all, I think the most important thing is what you just said, which is you called it Dreams of My Father, and the title of the book is actually Dreams from My Father.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that there's a big difference between those two things, especially since his use of that title, I think, is too obscure what was really there, which is that they are dreams of her, of his father, dreaming about his father and who his father was.
Mm-hmm.
But he talks about it as inherited dreams that he has taken on from his father, and those are the dreams that have to do with a united, with a world based on understanding, based on the triumph of reason, based on a place where people can really talk over their differences and learn about what they have in common, which was certainly his father's message as conveyed by the mother and to some extent by the father himself in his early days.
Mm-hmm. And the turbulence that we just described that he encountered as he was growing up, let me just say that nobody is really normal. Everybody has challenges and perceived deficiencies in their lives. And his rewriting of his own history and the messages that he picked up, mostly from his mother, some of it being transmitted on behalf of his absent father, these essentially amount to a rewriting of history in many respects. And I come from a family where my grandmother could not acknowledge the dark aspects of our family history. Everything was always perfect and rosy, and if she had written a book, I think it would have been a lot alike, similar to some of the kind of reconstruction that Obama did of his own personal history.
Yes. All I can say is yes. There's a reconstruction that is, on the one hand, somewhat glossed over certain problems. But on the other hand, it's a reconstruction that is at times painfully honest about himself and about his own shortcomings as a person growing up, how he was insensitive at times to the suffering of other people, etc. But the main thing that is missing in the book from, there are two things that are missing in his autobiography that that really struck me. One was any clear confrontation with his mother, any kind of anger at her, because she really did abandon him also several different times, and she put her career ahead of being a mother, I think, in many ways. That's the first thing, that he doesn't really address that directly except once, very briefly, when he's in high school. He writes about how he thought to himself when his mother was angry at him about not having studied, he thought to himself, you know, your experiment failed, Mom.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't say that out loud. At least he said that to the reader.
Yeah.
But he saw himself as her experiment. And the second thing I think that is missing in terms of a very clear picture is that he depicts how he can have very deep, profound emotions and nobody would know it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really struck by that story that he, and I spent a lot of time in the book on that he had a story that he told where he was 9 years old in Jakarta. He was reading through a Life magazine, and there was a picture of a black man that had disturbed him, and he looked at it closely, and it was a story about black Americans, Negroes, who are wanting to dye their skin so they can pass for white. And he was terribly upset by this. Of course, he writes this in his 30s, but looking back at it, he felt hot, angry, enraged, and very upset about the idea that somebody could hate themselves so much that they would hate their own skin. And I really think that's a profound idea, that he thought that. But what struck me was that after he thought that, he said he had this impulse to run and ask his mother and tell her about it, because she was working. It was in the library where she was working. And to tell her boss, who was himself African-American, asked him if he knew about this thing. And instead, he re-put the magazines back, and when his mother came to fetch him after work at 6 o'clock, he had just a calm smile on his face as if nothing had happened. And that's his strength and his weakness. But what it means is that he didn't have enough connection or confidence in his relationship to his mother that he would share with her what he was going through.
Dr. Frank, you also suggest in the book that Stanley Ann Dunham may not have been the Madonna figure that Barack Obama presents in most of his depictions of her. And after all, she chased men who were older, and I don't want to be racist about it, but it's a fair observation that she was attracted to men of color.
Yes, she was. And that was not... it's funny that I wrote about this in my book and had a sense of this, but really, it was much of that was unearthed by a biography of the mother by Janie Scott, who was a reporter in Boston, who did an extensive study of the mother and a history and interviewed over 200 different people who knew her. And there wasn't a lot of talk about the mother's sexual erotic life, but there was enough to make it pretty clear that the mother really did like men and went after them. She was certainly not a Madonna, but everybody's mother is pure in some way to the young boy. I can forgive him that a little bit. But I think what was striking was, again, one incident that... she described in the book that I don't remember, I don't think I wrote about, but it was essentially that about maternal indifference, and it was essentially that a friend of hers was visiting in Jakarta around the time he was 9, and Barry was walking down the street. The mother was walking in the between Barry and this and her friend, so the three of them were walking down the street together. There were boys throwing rocks at Barry. And what I realized from reading that book, but also from just learning more about Indonesia, it's a very racist country, and racist against blacks and people with dark skin, which really came as a bit of a surprise to me. And they were throwing rocks at him, and the friend said to the mother, said to Stanley Ann, aren't you, you know, they're throwing rocks at your son. And she says, oh, that doesn't bother him. He can deal with it. Mm-hmm. These rocks don't bother him. Now, as a parent, I would be at least screaming at the boys to stop, especially if when my son's 9 years old, or I would be, you know, huddling him to me. But she was struck by the kind of seeming either confidence that Stanley Ann had in Barry, but I have to call that some form of indifference that is peculiar to me.
Yeah.
And I think that they have what's called a dismissive attachment. He never talks about missing his mother in the book. He talks once about missing that he didn't have a father. But for the most part, there's not a lot about longing. But what he did long for, and the one thing he talked about longing for, of all the longings, and this is, I think, key to his adult life and his presidency, he was longing for a family. He came from a broken home, as you've said, as we've said, two broken homes. One broken originally when his father left, and then the second one when she left Jakarta with Barry and brought him back to Hawaii when he was 10. There was also a broken home there. And he never talked about missing Lolo, who was his stepfather, but what he did miss and yearn for was a family. He wanted to belong to a group. He wanted to belong somewhere, and he would do anything to belong to a group. He tells a story of in the fourth grade when he had one black friend in his school who was a young girl who he gave the name Coretta to, which is an interesting name to use, and gave her the name Coretta, and talked about how He was teased, and people, all of his friends were saying, "You're Coretta. Coretta's got a boyfriend. Coretta's got a boyfriend." And he pushed her away and said, "She's not my girlfriend," because he didn't want to be ostracized by these boys. So he was willing to hurt her, and I was thinking about that, not that I made that direct link, but you can see how he's pushed away his supporters in order to belong to a group, which is a group that is not interested in him, which is the many leaders of the Republican Party, especially John Boehner.
Well, and as a member of the professional left, I take great umbrage of that, Dr. Frank.
Yes.
Now, one thing I want to stress here is we have offered these observations about the parenting and family life of President Obama. And I think that your book is really well, its tone is really appropriate, Dr. Frank, because you offer these observations, but you don't move to judgment.
No.
And I think that's really important to stress for people who may be dubious about picking up a book of analysis of a patient that you have never seen. But I think that you do a marvelous job of marshaling information that is available on the public record and from the president's own expressions. And you look at them in light of his campaign and now his service as president. And you offer very interesting ways of us for us to interpret and analyze his actions against his background. But it is not a book of judgment, and you don't cross that line, and I, for one, am grateful for that.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. Love me, baby. Everybody knows that you really do. Everybody knows that you've been faithful, give or take a night or two. Everybody knows you've been discreet, but there were so many people you just had to meet without your clothes. And everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Now or never. Everybody knows that it's me or you. And everybody knows that you live forever, when you've done a line or two. Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. And everybody knows. Everybody knows that the plague is coming. Everybody knows that it's moving fast. Everybody knows that the naked man and woman are just to the past. Everybody knows the scene is dead, but there's gonna be a meter on your bed that will disclose what everybody knows. And everybody knows that you're in trouble. Everybody knows what you've been through, from the bloody cross on top of Calvary to the beach in Malibu. Everybody knows it's coming upon. Take one last look at this sacred heart before it blows. And everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows, that's how it goes. Oh, everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows.
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
And now for something completely different.